July 10th, 1991. A young woman is shot to death by her ex-boyfriend in a motel room in El Dorado, Arkansas. The woman is known to her friends as Mercedes, but has been living under a stolen identity. Even when her killer is apprehended, he does not provide any answers about who she really is. When an extensive check into her background fails to uncover her true identity, she becomes known as El Dorado Jane Doe. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 8 of The Trail Went Cold. I am your host, Robin Warder, and this episode is going to be our very first foray into a very interesting subject for true crime and mystery buffs, unidentified decedents. As you probably know, whenever a man or woman is found deceased and their identity cannot be established by police or the medical examiner, they become known as either John Doe or Jane Doe. Well, believe it or not, there are numerous decedents who never get identified. For various reasons, investigators just cannot uncover who these people really are, so they remain known as John Doe or Jane Doe forever. It's particularly tragic when these decedents have been murdered, and the police can't even figure out the identity of the victim, let alone who their killer is. Well, thankfully, there is a very prominent website devoted to this subject known as the Doe Network, which is an online database containing profiles for thousands of unidentified decedents. It's a non-profit organization run by volunteers and is essentially known as Facebook for the dead. And it has actually played a role in helping around 70 John and Jane Does get their identity back. It's a common practice for investigators and amateur cyber sleuths with a lot of time on their hands to browse profiles on the Doe Network and cross-check them with missing persons reports. And sometimes they actually get a match, meaning that two cold cases get solved for the price of one. The story I'm going to be covering today is profiled on the Doe Network, and it's one of their more unique cases. The victim is known as El Dorado Jane Doe, and on the surface, it seems quite amazing that this case has gone unsolved for nearly 25 years. On most Doe Network profiles, they're forced to use forensic facial reconstructions or composite sketches to give you an idea of what the victim looked like. But in the case of El Dorado Jane Doe, they were able to provide actual photographs of the victim, but she has still never been identified. I once featured this case in an article I wrote for listverse.com titled 10 Mysterious Cases Involving Unidentified People, which was published in June 2013. And the main reason I wanted to cover this story is because it has an unlikely tie-in to another case I covered on a previous episode of this podcast. But we'll get to that a little later. But before we get started, I want to thank all my loyal listeners and supporters out there, especially those from the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. A lot of you have provided some great suggestions for cases to cover on future episodes, and I hope to feature at least some of them, since some of our past episodes have been listener suggestions. As a reminder, The Trail Went Cold runs on a bi-weekly schedule, and a new episode is posted every other Wednesday. We've got our own Facebook and Twitter pages, and another big thank you to all my followers there. We're available for download on iTunes, so if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. And here's another big piece of news. The Trail Went Cold is also now available on Stitcher, so be sure to check out our page there as well. If you give us a rating or a review on iTunes or Stitcher, you're opening the door for us to get more exposure on both those platforms and garner us some potential new listeners. I need to provide the obligatory shout-out to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and is my fellow co-owner of The Back Row, the pop culture website which hosts this very podcast. And, of course, a big shout-out to Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. So, with that out of the way, let's begin the mysterious tale of El Dorado Jane Doe. Our story begins on July 10th, 1991, at the Whitehall Motel in El Dorado, Arkansas. The motel is a seedy place which is not exactly located in the best part of town, and it's known for being a haven for drugs and prostitution. Well, on this particular afternoon, there is a murder at the Whitehall Motel, as numerous witnesses hear a gunshot from inside one of the rooms and see a black man fleeing the scene. A check of the room reveals that a young blonde woman who appears to be in her 20s has been shot to death. And there's no mystery about who was responsible. The room is registered to a man named James McAlphin, who was the same man seen fleeing the area. Shortly before the shooting, a guest named Roy Charles Manon had knocked on the door to McAlphin's room. And when McAlphin opened the door, Manon saw the blonde woman inside. When the blonde woman tried to leave, McAlphin hit her, dragged her back into the room, and shut the door. Manon then overheard the couple get into a loud argument before the shooting occurred, and McAlphin took off. At around the same time, a woman named Andrea Cooksey was passing by the motel, and she also heard the gunshot. So she also ran into the room to find the blonde woman dead. When the police arrived, Cooksey told them that the blonde was a friend of hers, and that her name was Mercedes. According to Cooksey, James McAlphin was Mercedes' ex-boyfriend, and she was trapped in an abusive relationship. In fact, the investigation would uncover records of multiple instances where Mercedes was forced to visit the emergency room because her boyfriend had inflicted injuries on her. McAlphin had a pretty extensive criminal record, and it was also alleged that he functioned as Mercedes' pimp. 1 month before the shooting, Mercedes actually worked up the courage to leave him, and she moved in with Andrea Cooksey. But earlier that day, McAlphin had called up Mercedes and promised to give her some money if she met him at the Whitehall Motel. And unfortunately, she wound up dead. This might sound like a pretty simplistic case, but it would soon become a lot more complicated. You see, even though everyone knew the victim as Mercedes, she actually carried a social security card and an identity card with the name Cheryl Ann Wick. In fact, police records would show that during the past several months, she had been arrested in both El Dorado and Dallas for such offenses as prostitution and writing bad checks, and she was always booked under the name Cheryl Ann Wick. She also used that name while working at a KFC in Dallas the year before. Well, investigators used Cheryl's social security number to find out that she hailed from Minneapolis and that her family still lived there. So they call up Cheryl's parents to tell them their daughter was dead, and then, whoops, turns out they put them through an emotional ordeal for nothing. Because they soon end up talking to the real Cheryl Ann Wick, who is alive and well and living in Minneapolis. That's right, Mercedes had actually stolen Cheryl Ann Wick's identity. And unfortunately, the real Cheryl can't shed any light on this whole situation, as she claims she never met Mercedes and has no idea who she is. It seems likely that Mercedes probably stole Cheryl's social security card and identity card from her purse at some point, and Cheryl just never noticed. So, who exactly is this woman then? Well, according to Andrea Cooksey, Mercedes claimed that she was from out of town and that she used to be a stripper. She also mentioned having two kids who were being raised by her mother. In fact, the main reason Mercedes was willing to take a risk and go back to see her abusive ex-boyfriend was because McAlphin had promised to give her money, and she wanted to buy some presents to send home to her kids. So what about James McAlphin? Could he provide some answers about this woman's identity? Well, it wasn't long before McAlphin turned himself into the police, and, well, he turned out to be a real piece of work, to say the least. He claimed that he had gotten into a scuffle with Mercedes where she stole his gun from him, and then decided to kill herself. In fact, to this very day, the guy still maintains that Mercedes committed suicide. Never mind all those witnesses who saw McAlphin fleeing the scene with the actual gun in his hand. Anyway, when asked about their relationship, McAlphin claimed that he met Mercedes while she was working as a topless dancer in Dallas, and that they had been together for about a year. He said Mercedes once told him that she was from Oklahoma, and he also claimed that he had met Mercedes' mother and sister. Apparently, earlier that year, the couple was living in Shreveport, Louisiana, when Mercedes' mother and sister traveled from Florida to visit them, but McAlphin wouldn't actually provide their names. McAlphin was initially charged with first-degree murder, and the case against him looked pretty damning. But, ultimately, there were no other witnesses in that motel room who could verify that McAlphin pulled the trigger and could disprove that Mercedes shot herself. So in the end, he decided to take a plea agreement and pled guilty to second-degree murder. McAlphin wound up receiving a 15-year sentence, and he served 13 of them before he was released. So since the murder was solved very easily, the authorities now focused all their energies at figuring out Mercedes' true identity. And there were some intriguing clues to work with in Mercedes' personal belongings. She seemed to have this unique habit of collecting menus from restaurants she visited, and they found menus from establishments in Texas and Virginia. A page was found from a diary she had written in, and she referenced staying with a couple named Tyrone and Gail in August of 1990. She also mentioned that Gail's grandmother was in Fresno and had recently suffered a heart attack. This would have been around the same time period in which McAlphin claimed that he and Mercedes were living in Shreveport. And one more interesting clue. Mercedes also had a Bible containing the names of numerous people inside, most of which had the last name Stroud. The investigators followed this lead, and they did locate a family named Stroud who lived in Irving, Texas, and they learned that Mercedes had briefly stayed with them in 1990. And she had also told the Stroud family that her name was Cheryl Ann Wick, that she was a runaway from Louisiana, and that her original hometown was Minneapolis. In fact, the further the authorities dug, the bigger the rabbit hole it seemed to become. In the years prior to her death, Mercedes seemed to live in many different places, under many different names, and cross paths with many different people. In addition to Cheryl Ann Wick, Mercedes was known to go by such names as Cheryl Kaufman, Shannon Wiley, Sharon Wiley, and Helen Stenner. She also went by the name Kelly Lee Carr, and apparently she told some people she was wanted in Virginia for bank robbery under that name, but I don't think police ever found any evidence that that was true. Mercedes seemed to tell a number of crazy tales to the different people she encountered. Another story was that her father was in the mafia and that she was living in a witness protection program. In March 1991, Mercedes had a brief stay at the Salvation Army in El Dorado, and she told a volunteer that she had once lived in a Dallas homeless shelter where social services took away her child. And since Mercedes was supposedly living under a fake name at that time, she was unable to get her child back. But remember, Mercedes also told her friend Andrea Cooksey that she had two children who were being raised by her mother. So was this alleged child from the Dallas homeless shelter one of those two children? Or was this an entirely different child? Who really knows if anything Mercedes told to anybody was true? Well, in spite of having all this information to work with, investigators just kept hitting a dead end. Even though Mercedes had interacted with so many people and told so many different stories, they just could not figure out who she really was. And what was most frustrating was that Mercedes had a bunch of photographs of herself which they could publicize, but they still came up empty. Yes, there were a lot of people who did recognize her, but it seemed like all of them had interacted with her within the past few years, and none of them knew where she actually came from. And since they just could not verify her real name, she simply became known as El Dorado Jane Doe. To this day, all those photos are posted on her profile page at the Doe Network for the entire internet to see, yet she has never been conclusively identified. They've cross-checked her with missing persons cases involving young women, but they've never been able to make a definitive match. The investigators have photographs, they have DNA, they have fingerprints, yet after nearly 25 years, they still come up empty. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Until very recently. You see, a few months ago, there was quite an interesting development. After James McAlphin served his sentence for second-degree murder, he got into some more trouble with the law. Surprise, surprise. In June 2011, McAlphin went back to prison after he was convicted of second-degree domestic battering, and he's currently serving a 10-year sentence. Well, just this past March, the Huffington Post published a very extensive article about the El Dorado Jane Doe case, because McAlphin is now claiming that he knows her true identity, and he's willing to break his silence and tell her entire story. If he's paid $4,000, of course. Until he gets some money, McAlphin is only going to provide tantalizing hints for now. But what's most interesting is that McAlphin also claims that if he reveals Mercedes' true identity, it could also lead to the closure of a few other cold cases. Now, you're going to have to take the following information with a huge grain of salt, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. Okay, so according to McAlphin, Mercedes was 26 years old when they first met, but had been working the streets since she was 16. This guy who she'd fallen for had apparently forced her into prostitution, but she eventually settled into that lifestyle willingly. Before she met McAlphin, Mercedes had worked with a pimp named JD, but then she ran away from him after hooking up with another pimp named Tyrone. And if you'll recall, there was a mention of a Tyrone in that page from Mercedes' diary. Investigators were able to verify that JD was actually a real person, a Dallas-based pimp named Jeffrey Davis. They suspect that Tyrone could have been Mercedes' pimp while she was living in Florida, but they've never been able to track this guy down. Now here's the interesting part. JD apparently had a bunch of other girls in his stable, some of whom had been kidnapped. And McAlphin claims that Mercedes was friends with three girls who were abducted from a Fort Worth shopping mall during the 1970s. And let me tell you, I actually got chills the first time I read that. Because it sounds like McAlphin is referring to the Fort Worth Three, a case I covered 3 months ago in the second episode of this very podcast. So in case you're not familiar with the case, the Fort Worth Three are 17-year-old Mary Rachel Terlisa, 14-year-old Lisa Renee Wilson, and 9-year-old Julie Ann Mosley, who all vanished during a Christmas shopping trip to a mall in Fort Worth, Texas, on December 23, 1974. Their vehicle was found abandoned in the mall parking lot, but the girls just disappeared without explanation. The following morning, Rachel's husband received a letter supposedly written by her, in which he claimed that the three of them had all run off to Houston, but would return within a week. But of course, they never did, and there was a lot of doubt that Rachel actually wrote that letter. Now, according to McAlphin, the Fort Worth Three were abducted and raised in captivity as part of a stable of prostitutes, and Mercedes became so close to them that they were apparently like sisters. He also mentioned that the youngest girl, who would have been Julianne Mosley, he's claiming that she died at some point while giving birth. What's particularly interesting about this story is that during the late 1990s, a private investigator named Dan James approached the victims' families and claimed that he'd uncovered evidence to suggest that Rachel and Renee had taken off because something happened to Julianne. He said Renee and Julianne were both deceased by this point, but Rachel was still alive. But unfortunately, James never revealed any specific details about why he believed this, and I don't think they've ever uncovered any hard evidence to support his theory. Yet it is fascinating to hear McAlphin tell this similar story about something bad happening to Julianne, and the girls being alive for several years after they disappeared. But alas, investigators have openly stated that McAlphin is a pathological liar, and no one should believe anything he says. So, I have my doubts that there's any truth to his claims that El Dorado Jane Doe is connected to the Fort Worth 3 case. But It was pretty exciting to see that case get some exposure in the Huffington Post only 2 weeks after I recorded a podcast on it. However, there is a possible connection between El Dorado Jane Doe and another cold case which I find very intriguing. In 1990, Unsolved Mysteries aired a segment on the murder of Dwayne McCorkendale, a 27-year-old truck driver from Kansas City, Kansas. On November 12, 1988, Dwayne was in the midst of delivering a load to Oklahoma City when he decided to pull over at a rest stop near the town of Chandler. Now remember, this is the pre-cell phone era, so Dwayne actually had to stop and go use a payphone because he wanted to call his wife. Anyway, when he stepped into the phone booth, someone fired a shotgun blast into his back. Since Dwayne's wallet was missing, robbery was the apparent motive, but he was only believed to be carrying around $25 on him at the time, so this was a particularly horrific and senseless crime. The guy left behind a wife and twin daughters, and unfortunately, I thought this case might be unsolvable because there was very little to go on. I always figured the killer was a desperate drug addict or something, and it seemed likely they would either be dead by now or incarcerated for another crime. The only major lead in this case was a brown Ford Pinto, which was seen playing dangerous games of cat and mouse on the Oklahoma highways around the time of Dwayne's murder. The Pinto was driving erratically around the road and deliberately cutting off these big 18-wheeler trucks. The occupants of the Pinto had a CB radio on them, so other truckers would hear them say over the airwaves, "We already killed one trucker, we have no problems killing another." Right before he was killed, Dwayne had actually said over the CB radio that he was pulling over at the next rest stop to call his wife. So it's possible that the folks in the Pinto could have heard Dwayne say this on their CB and decided to ambush him and kill him. In fact, the day before Dwayne's murder, another truck driver named Ed Heitkamp was parked at a different rest stop eating his lunch when a young blonde woman approached him. She was acting very strangely and asking Heitkamp for money, and even went so far as to climb onto his rig and attempt to force his way into the truck. When Heitkamp wouldn't let her inside, a brown Ford Pinto pulled up containing a white male and a black male, so the woman jumped off the truck and drove off with him. This occurred only 13 miles away from the rest stop where Dwayne McCorkendale was killed, so it's very possible that the occupants of that Ford Pinto committed the murder. So what does this have to do with the El Dorado Jane Doe case? Well, at some point, Mercedes apparently told people she was on the run because she was involved in a murder. According to Mercedes, a black male companion of hers would make her frequent truck stops and lure drivers out of the rig so they could rob them. However, Mercedes claimed her companion actually shot and killed one of these truck drivers. So there are a lot of intriguing questions here. Was Mercedes the blonde woman who tried to force her way into Ed Heitkamp's truck the day before Dwayne McCorkendale was killed? Was her black companion the same man seen in the brown Ford Pinto? Could this man have been her former pimp, JD? Was he responsible for Dwayne McCorkendale's murder? While investigators have never been able to find any definitive evidence to connect Mercedes with this particular crime, it's certainly a very interesting possibility. Overall, we have received so many tantalizing clues about Mercedes' backstory, but there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle which don't seem to fit together. But I'm going to do my best to try and make sense out of this whole thing. Now, let's just start with the unlikely scenario that James McAlphin is 100% telling the truth about Mercedes' backstory. The big problem here is that we can't even be sure if everything Mercedes told him was accurate. Remember, they'd only known each other for about a year before she was killed. Mercedes told a lot of different stories about herself to a lot of different people, and it's a given that at least some of those stories were untrue. So even if McAlphin is being legitimately truthful, he could just be relaying false information which Mercedes fed to him. If Mercedes actually told him that she was friends with the missing girls from the Fort Worth 3 case, how do we know she wasn't lying about that? But I am inclined to agree with the investigators. You really just cannot believe one word which comes out of James McAlphin's mouth. If he really does know Mercedes' true identity, I really don't see why he'd wait so long to reveal it. Granted, the guy received a sweet plea deal in which he only got 15 years for Mercedes' murder, but if McAlphin actually had any substantial information about her, he probably would have used it as a bargaining chip a long time ago. And let's not forget that he received a 10-year sentence for domestic battering back in 2011. Yet he's waiting until his sentence is halfway over before he decides to tell the truth? I think that McAlphin is nothing more than a narcissistic attention seeker who's trying to earn himself a little extra cash. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some kernels of truth in everything he said, but I really have my doubts that Mercedes has any real connection to the Fort Worth 3 case. I know that it's not unheard of for young girls to be kidnapped and forced into prostitution, but I just find it far-fetched that 3 girls of 3 different ages could all be abducted and forced into sex slavery at the exact same time. Sadly, I still believe that all 3 of those girls were murdered shortly after they disappeared. But the Dwayne McCorkindale murder? I could go either way on that one. Remember, it wasn't James McAlphin who shared the story about a murder truck driver. That came from Mercedes herself. If she was referring to Dwayne McCorkindale, then that means McAlphin wouldn't have been involved since the crime took place in 1988, 2 years before they met. So this would point to Mercedes' former pimp JD being the potential trigger man. We do know that JD was a real pimp named Jeffrey Davis, but there doesn't seem to be any hard information about him out there, so I'm not sure if he has a history of being involved in murder. It is strange that Mercedes would be so open about admitting to people that she was involved in a murder, but I suppose it's possible that JD could have enlisted her in a scheme to rob truck drivers, but she just didn't expect anyone to get killed. Hell, for all we know, this incident might have been what motivated Mercedes to finally get away from JD. McAlphin did say that Mercedes once told him that she was from Oklahoma, which is where this crime took place. The paper trail on her only seems to date back to early 1990, so it's not impossible that Mercedes could have been frequenting Oklahoma during this time period. I would be really interested to know if Ed Heitkamp was ever shown a photograph of Mercedes, just so he could confirm if she might be the same blonde woman who tried to force his way into his truck. Unfortunately, it's been over 27 years, and I have no idea if Ed Heitkamp would even still be alive today, but it would be neat if he saw the photo and could make a positive ID. If there's one thing I'm skeptical about, it's that Heitkamp claimed the blonde woman looked like a drug addict who was clearly desperate to get money for her next fix. Even though Mercedes had a rough background, I don't think there was ever any indication that she was a drug addict, but I still won't completely rule out the possibility that this woman might have been her. But putting aside all these other unsolved cold cases, there's still a big question that everyone wants answered. The true identity of El Dorado Jane Doe. And does she actually have 2 kids out there who have no idea what happened to their mother? Well, there are a lot of contradictory stories about whether or not Mercedes actually had children. Mercedes claimed that her mother was taking care of her 2 kids, but McAlphin, he claims that Mercedes had 2 kids and that she left them with someone in Fort Worth. Yet McAlphin also claims that he met Mercedes' mother and sister and that they traveled from Florida, but I don't believe he ever made mention of meeting Mercedes' kids. And there's also that story Mercedes shared about having her child taken away from her while she was in a homeless shelter in Dallas. So, what's the real truth here? Well, if I had to guess, I'd say the homeless shelter story is probably the most likely scenario to be true. I have my doubts about Mercedes' claims that her mother was looking after her children. I know that Mercedes said that she and her mother didn't get along, but unless her mom completely disowned her and cut her out of her life altogether, why hasn't she tried harder to find her? Remember, Mercedes claimed that the main reason she went back to see McAlphin at the motel was because he promised to give her money, which she would use to buy presents to send to her kids. This would seem to imply that Mercedes stayed in contact with her family and liked to send them stuff. When they suddenly stopped hearing from her, did they not start asking questions? Of course, I'm not saying this kind of thing doesn't happen. In recent years, we've had numerous John and Jane Does get identified who had completely broken off all contact with their family several years earlier. In those cases, the family either didn't care about the victim enough to report them missing, or they just ran into a bunch of bureaucratic red tape with the authorities and the case got lost in the shuffle. However, it's a very unique situation for a person to leave behind two kids and never get reported missing. If Mercedes did have kids who were raised by her relatives, they would be grown adults now, and you'd think they would have spent the last several years wondering what happened to their mother. So my gut instinct is that Mercedes was lying, and that if she did have a child at some point, they were probably taken away from her, and that child doesn't have any idea who their birth mother might be. Sadly, I think there's a pretty logical reason why Mercedes has never been identified. If there's anyone out there who does know the real truth, they aren't going to recognize all those photographs of her. And that's because, the last time they saw her, she would have looked totally different. In other words, she was probably either abandoned, abducted, or ran away from home at a very young age. If Mercedes disappeared at, say, age 12 or 13... then those photographs of her as an adult aren't going to do much good. Who knows? Maybe the people who do know Mercedes' identity do recognize her in those photos, but they just don't care. Hell, it's possible Mercedes doesn't even know who her biological family is and spent her childhood being a ward of the state before she went off on her own. It sounds like she led a transient lifestyle for most of her existence, and she probably never knew what it was like to have a stable home. And unfortunately, she eventually got mixed up in some bad stuff, including prostitution and possibly even murder, and then she wound up with an abusive, controlling partner who eventually killed her. Yes, this recent Huffington Post article might prompt more people who remember Mercedes to come forward, but even if they did interact with her at some point in the past, how many of them will actually know who she is? I have a sad feeling that the amount of people out there who know the full truth about Mercedes' backstory might either be minuscule or non-existent. That said, I'm not going to give up hope that El Dorado Jane Doe will be identified someday. As the internet has been an invaluable tool for solving cold cases like this. Let me put it this way. My ListVerse article which featured El Dorado Jane Doe, 10 Mysterious Cases Involving Unidentified People, it was published 3 years ago, and since then, 3 out of the 10 cases on that list have been solved. In fact, I can name at least a dozen cold cases involving unidentified decedents which have been solved within the last few years, and many of these cases were decades old. Believe it or not, a lot of these stories found closure because someone was browsing the internet one day, came across a story about an unidentified John or Jane Doe, looked at the forensic reconstruction of their face, and thought, hey, that looks like my missing sister, or that looks like a girl I went to high school with, or I remember hanging around a guy who looked just like that 20 years ago. These people then provided a tip to the proper authorities, and when DNA testing conclusively matched the decedent to a missing person, the unidentified victim finally got their name back again. In the past, a lot of these cases might have been impossible to solve, but with all the technological advances we've had these past few decades, no case is unsolvable. I can only hope for a scenario where somebody is surfing the internet, comes across Mercedes's photograph, and says, I know exactly who this is. If that happens, this case will be solved, and El Dorado Jane Doe will finally have her identity back. So as I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to remind everyone that our website is currently providing a link to El Dorado Jane Doe's profile page at the Doe Network. This page contains her photographs, vital statistics, and contact info for the proper authorities should you happen to have any important information. If you think you recognize El Dorado Jane Doe or have some idea who she might be, please call in a tip. But if you just have your own theory about who she might be, I'd still love to hear from you. Hell, if you have some interesting information about this case which wasn't covered here on this episode, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email. In my previous episodes, I gave out an email address as robin.warder@primus.ca. But that address could very well change sometime in the future, so I'm going to give you a new one. If you'd like to get in touch, please email me at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. robin.warder@icloud.com. And also, be sure to check out The Trail Went Cold on Facebook and Twitter. And like I mentioned at the start of this podcast, we're now available on both iTunes and Stitcher, so be sure to leave us a rating or a review at either of those places, because that will help garner us more exposure. You can also check out my true crime and mystery articles at crack.com and listverse.com, and there's plenty of other non-true crime content you can find right here at the Back Row. So have yourself a good 2 weeks, and join me next time for another edition of The Trail Went Cold.
The Trail Went Cold is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The theme song was composed by Vince Nitro. We'll be right back.